Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Eric.
How are you?
I am pretty good. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. We just got back from a walk that we took across the park, and we visited our friend Ashley, and it happened to be around 7 o'clock at night, which is when everyone leans out their windows or out their balcony or walks across the street and starts applauding or banging pots and pans or playing instruments.
Or singing Celine Dion or playing a trumpet.
But it is all for the purpose of bigging up healthcare workers and people who are doing essential work and those that are out there on the front lines. In addition to, I think there is this idea where it's like, hey, I'm a human. I'm locked inside, most of the day, every day. I want to be heard. And I think that it's a very powerful thing. It's been happening for at least 2 months now, ever since we've all been in quarantine. And it is still a very, very important thing, I think, and I found very moving.
Yeah.
And then we at the same time walked a couple blocks and ran into a guy who was playing bagpipes and he was performing Amazing Grace, and that was very moving. So
yeah,
a good start to the evening, I think.
Yeah,
a little pick me up.
I mean, it was also like it rained before and it was so nice when we went outside. If there's a metaphor there, hopefully somebody can find it.
That's right. Let us know in the comments.
Yeah.
Jeff, I do want to mention that this episode here today with Clark Kent and Naima Cochran and Jeff Sledge is a loving tribute to the incomparable and unforgettable music executive, artist, culture...
Shifter,
yeah. Mover and shaker and creator... Andre Harrell, who, maybe you know him, maybe you don't. I think this episode is important for all the things you're going to hear about him being a friend, about him being a visionary, and I think being a very important person to so many people. And he really, not only created this new era of what hip-hop and what R&B and what soul could be, but for youth in America, and particularly black youth in America, he showed you a different kind of success and a different way forward. And I think this episode is really important because we got to learn a lot. This
yeah.
is not, somebody who we were best friends with or even ever met in life.
No, the one time that I was even in the same room as him, I think, was I went to Heavy D's funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him speak, and he said, of Heavy... whose career was really in his hands.
Yeah.
He said that Heavy, when he was dancing, he didn't know how big he was. Like, he moved like he didn't know how big he was. And if there's any metaphor to come from that for Andre Harrell, I think that his impact is so much bigger than who he is, who he was. And, I think that even though his most forward-facing stuff was before our time,
mm-hmm.
I think that his impact has been just felt forever since and will go on forever more. So.
Beautifully spoken. Rest in peace to Andre Harrell, and we're sending our love and thoughts to anybody and everybody who is affected by this, and I think that is a large, large, large group of us.
Yeah.
So look forward to a great episode ahead of you, and I just want to say, too, shout out to everybody who is a Patreon member at patreon.com/itsthereal. That is a way for you guys out there to be involved in what we're doing in here. And I think when I say that, it's not just this episode today. It's not just the 40-something episodes before this. It's also a string of quality material that we've put out for 13 years. It's proof of what we have done and what we will do in the future. And if you want to be a part of that, the best way forward is to go to patreon.com/itsthereal and make a donation that goes over every month, whether it's $2 or $3 a month or even $5 or $10 or even more. If you feel like this is something you want to invest in, if you think that we're something you want to invest in, that is the place to go.
Yeah, I just think that we have a fucking dope platform. And I think that if you want to support that, that'd be great.
That would be. We would not complain.
I refuse to complain if you...
There's so much to complain about.
Yeah.
That's not one of them.
No.
So here's what we're going to do. We're going to get into this episode. Again, this one is dedicated to the life and memory of Andre Harrell. Long live Andre Harrell, the music he created and the culture that he loved. Jeff, let's get on the phone now with Clark Kent.
Hello? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
The one and only God's favorite DJ, Clark Kent.
Yeah, what up?
What's happening? How are you?
There you go. I'm good. I'm good. How are you?
Good. Good to hear from you. How has the last, it's been like probably, man, maybe like a month and a half since we spoke with you. How are you doing, you and your family?
I'm okay. You know, taking it a day at a time. You know, it's a little weird. Like, ever so often you hear about somebody else, us leaving someone else, and then it makes you pray harder that, you know, the people that are close to you or in your family, that you don't leave them. But then that's kind of selfish to not be playing for everyone. But, you know, in those moments, you know what I mean? Like, you find out somebody passed, and then you, like, pray for your family, and, like, instead of playing for everybody all the time. Everybody's in my thoughts. I really wish there was a switch that you could turn, and nobody would be passing away. You know what I mean? 2020 has been crazy.
It's been a lot to handle. I think, you know, we have to sort of, like you said, take it day by day and moment by moment. And as we move forward, we like to pay tribute to those who are here, obviously, and we want to sing the praises of those who have left us. I guess we'll start off with the great Andre Harrell. Clark, I texted you the other day because the post that you put up the morning after the news was just super meaningful, super powerful, and this is somebody that not only changed, you know, how culture looked, how culture sounded, and how culture felt for the next, you know, 20 years, 25 years ahead, but this is somebody that was your friend. Can you talk about your friend, Andre Harrell?
Yeah. The thing is, like, I don't even know if I could say that he changed culture more than I can say that he is culture. Mm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So many of the people that come from him are the luminaries. You know what I'm saying? Like, if he doesn't change the way it looks, then it doesn't look like you. We don't understand grown and sexy. We don't understand ghetto fabulous. We don't understand rappers being rich. We mm-hmm. don't understand rappers being executives. We don't understand. We don't understand it without it happening through Andre Harrell. Like, he built so much of what you see today. It's kind of, I completely look at him like he's the culture. You know, he is the culture.
And this is somebody that you met while he was at Rush or Def Jam early on?
No, I met Andre when he was a rapper.
Oh, right.
When he was putting out his first records, because I was a young DJ, and I used to find and meet and get to know and be in contact with all the artists that were making records. Of course, he's older than me, but still, I was out there, and I found him, and I met him and Alonzo, who was Mr. Hyde.
Yeah.
He was in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So I've really known them since I was a kid. And we were all kids, but they were older, of course. But we've always been cool. And then he started to, you know, when he went on to work with Russell, like, I would see him all the time because I was always around the movement. The thing was a real thing. Like, Def Jam was a real thing. The Rush offices was a real thing. And we would be there. And it's like the hip-hop game, the music business part of it was so small then that we all saw each other all the time.
So,
you know what I'm saying? So it was a real ill dynamic. So knowing him all those years is crazy, especially because of the shift that happened when he got his chance. When he got his chance, the shift was so crazy that he just started putting people on all over the place. You know what I'm saying? Like, he just made life a lot better for a lot of young black people. And, like, it's ill when you find somebody like that. He's special. He is a different kind of cloth. You are going to be hard pressed to find someone else of that cloth from that time period. I mean, he's like the second coming of Clarence Avon. Mm.
Just in that, like, he knew everybody, and the people that he knew, he put into power.
God, you want to, like, give a list?
No, I'm saying like I'm trying to, you know, get to the point of you know,
Heavy D.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mary J. Blige, Father and C, Jodeci. So that means he put on Devontae, who went on to produce tons of records, and Devontae was friends with Timbaland and Missy Elliott, who went on to become who they were. You see what I'm saying? Like his heritage, his family tree is insane. His family tree is Teddy Riley.
Yep.
That means after you heard Guy, everything that happened after Guy, the New Jack Swing, that's Andre Harrell's fault. You know what I'm saying? Everything. I'll be sure. Like that, all of this type of stuff is because of Andre, Uptown Records, and how he felt about young black beautifulness. You know what the crazy part? You gotta think. I named a bunch of names. I ain't even gotten a Puff Daddy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you know, just try to grasp that for a second. All those names that I mentioned, this is before I got the Puff Daddy. And then you saw what happened to Puff Daddy. So everything that comes from Puff Daddy is handed down from what comes from Andre Harrell.
Clark, can you expound on the difference between cool before Andre Harrell and cool after?
Cool after Andre Harrell looked better. You know what I'm saying? The rap game was the rap game. But Andre, when he was a rapper, him and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde wore three-piece suits on stage.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? When rap became big, it looked like Run-DMC. It looked like what you wore every day. But when he was a rapper, they were wearing three-piece suits on stage. There were other artists that were doing it, but they went to the records doing that. And when you went to see them perform, they were in three-piece suits. So when he evolved into becoming label owner and him dressing, like every time you saw Andre, he was fly. Even if he was in down clothes, his down clothes were fly.
Mm.
His T-shirt wasn't the same T-shirt that you bought. His sweats were of a different material. His sweats might have been cashmere while you chasing champions.
I didn't know he wore sweats.
and that's the thing, like, if you don't know, like, when you think Andre Harrell, you think this guy looks like he came out of a magazine all the time.
Yeah.
Even his downtime, he still looked magazine ready. Andre Harrell is the epitome of what ghetto fly shit is. He is that deal. Come on, man. Puff Daddy do parties with everybody wearing tuxedos because of Andre Harrell.
Well, I want to, you know, I feel like there's a pretty good picture of what he was like as a, you know, within hip hop and within the culture. I want to know, like, what was he like outside? Like, what did he like to do, like, as a friend? Like, was he somebody who liked to go to dinners? Was he somebody who liked to play golf? Like, what was he like in his extracurriculars?
This is a dude who could do the most ghetto shit, and you would feel like it was just different if he did it. So he could walk into a Chinese restaurant on a corner, and the Chinese restaurants just start to look shiny and pretty. Like, there's nothing that he didn't do. It's not like, this is a dude who did the Hamptons before it was cool to do the Hamptons.
Mm.
Even if it was just going to dinner, like, everybody going to this new fancy restaurant, Andre was three steps ahead of y'all. He was at the one that you would like after the next 2 year life. So if you were on Child's and he was somewhere in some French restaurant, you're not going to get to that French restaurant until you find two restaurants after the Child. Like, he's that deal. You know what I'm saying? Like, when he brought me to work at Motown Records, one of the first things he said was, I'm going to introduce you to Clarence Avon, and you need to talk to Clarence Avon regularly. So I was going to have breakfast with Clarence Avon every day.
Wow.
For a while when I was at Motown, because Andre said so.
Wow.
I mean, of course, I got a ton of game from Clarence, but we went to breakfast at the Four Seasons every day. You know what I'm saying? So, like, that's the kind of level of where he was at with it. He was like, you know, you got to think better. It's the other level.
Can you talk about what life was like when Heavy D got on the scene?
Well, the crazy part about Heavy D getting on the scene is I was with Dana Dane when all of this was going on. So when Heavy D came on the scene, we went on tour together. Like, first time they went on tour, we went on tour.
Mm.
So we were friends, like, immediately from everybody putting out records. And Andre was just this brainchild who was like, I'm going to take this big light-skinned dude, chubby light-skinned dude, and turn him into a sexy, jovial dude. But it's almost like Heavy D was the tall, light-skinned, chubby version of Andre Harrell, because he was always happy, too. He was happy. His music was jovial. His feeling was jovial. He was Andre Harrell in the rap form. It's crazy. Just being around all of that. Like, I used to hang out in Mount Vernon with Eddie F. and Hev and Albie Shaw and Easy Lee and all of them, just because we were all friends with Andre. Because we were all in that same mix at the same time. So we would go up there and hang out with them. It wasn't even, the crazy part is, it wasn't even a real reason. It just felt like, yeah, it's what you're supposed to do. We know each other and we're all around each other. Just go hang out with each other. Let's do it. And Andre promoted that.
Everyone says that Andre never had anything but a smile on his face, always had a great attitude. Have you ever seen him pressed?
I've seen him unhappy. I've seen him mad. And I've never seen him not smile right through it. I've seen him, like, maybe, you know, hint to something in an angry way, and I seen him smile right through it. I don't know, man. He was a totally different animal. I remember after I bought Jay-Z, I was like, yo, you got to sign Jay-Z. You got to sign my boy. My boy's the shit, you got to sign. He was like, yeah, nah. Right? Jay-Z, yo, listen, understand me. I'm his vice president at the company, and he's saying no to me about this, right? So I'm like, okay, cool. So Rockefeller comes off, does it all itself. You know what I'm saying? We put the records out. Everything goes crazy. We go to Jack the Rapper, and Andre Harrell is throwing the biggest party. I'm DJing. Ain't no nigga is going crazy. And in the party, he said, I fucked up, right? And I was like, yo. But I was like, yes, you fucked up. And he was like, you mad at me, right? I said, I've been mad since the day you said no. He was like, hey, listen, he said, it's all good. He said, I fucked up, you were right. You were right, DJ Clark Kent. I didn't follow your sexy move. That's what he said. And then he goes, when we get back, let's do a song deal. And I was like, what do you mean? He was like, let's do a song deal. So the songs that you didn't make, making albums with your name, he's going to make over here with us over here. And I'm like, how do you go from not signing to saying, well, fuck it, let's just do you a song deal? He that's the kind of guy he was. He empowered, like, everybody who was around him. Understand me, when he went to Motown, he took, like, 10 guys from the music, young black guys from the music business, and turned them into real A&R men and vice president. I was a director at another record company when he took me, and he was like, come on, you're going to be a vice president for me. And I'm looking at him like, what? I was like, oh, okay. You know what I'm saying? But change lives. Like, he's just like, I'm going to just do it. Like, he's special. I love the hell out of Andre. And though I didn't see him as much as other people did because he was on the West Coast, at least once, twice a month, it'll just be a call. Are you good? I'm good. How you doing? Always sounded the exact same way. Always sounded happy. It's just, that's why this is blowing my mind so much, man.
How have the past, like, 48 hours been for you? Like, how are you processing all this?
I'm trying to do what I believe he would say or he would want because of his spirit. So on Saturday, I did a block party with Jazzy Jeff for the release of Fresh Prince, the Fresh Prince gear with Bel Air.
Yeah.
Clothing. And in my set, I was like, damn, well, like, but I was totally like, what am I going to do? Because I heard the news, it was bugging me out, and I know that I got a DJ, and I'm like, well, what am I going to do? So I just thought, well, I'm going to do what Andre would have said. He would say, yo, just play. Like, it's a block party, let's have a block party. Like, that would have been Andre. Hey, it's a block party, let's have a block party. You know what I'm saying? And I had to go into block party mode with Andre in mind. So I'm trying to think of records Andre loved, and I'm trying to play them. The same thing when I had the next day on Sunday, we had to do the originals on D-Nice's live. And I'm like, what am I going to do? And then that morning, I heard about Betty Wright, who was also someone that I met and knew and seen her work. I thought she was amazing. I mean, she's a legend.
Legend, yeah.
So I'm like, what would Andre say? Andre be like, yo, nigga, play the button bus. So, you know, like the average person is going to look at it and go, well, I'm going to play a whole bunch of Andre records. And I'm like, Andre didn't like that. His records were his records. He would have been like, come on, let's party. Let's make it grown and sexy, my nigga. Let's make it grown and sexy. So I went to making it grown and sexy. And I pray that, you know, Andre is somewhere saying Clark Kent's out there doing the right for his man. You know?
Yeah.
Because this is really rough, man. It's rough, man. Andre the Wall was special, man. He was a different kind of cloth, man.
Clark, at the inception of Uptown Records, what's the one piece of vinyl that you got, you know, passed off from an Uptown rep or Andre himself that you knew that when you got into a party, you put that and you dropped that needle and the place would just explode?
I think one of the first records I can clearly remember him handing off might have been Uptown Kicking It. And I knew in the clubs that we were playing, oh yeah, that was going to ring off.
Mm.
And it rang off. You know, Uptown's Kicking It. This is before anybody made an album. Andre had Uptown's Kicking It. I'm with Vanessa Sinquist, Woody Rock, a whole bunch of other artists on the Heavy D and Boy. It was that deal. But it rang off. I knew it would ring off. But it's funny because I knew Andre, he had an idea, man. His idea was going to be young black opulence and things being fabulous and people getting money and not like getting money in a ghetto way, but getting money in an enterprising way feel good about it. Make sure that when you get money, it looks right. Make sure that. Don't just get money and buy a big chain. Make sure that suit looks right. So that means you can't buy a big chain because a big chain looks stupid on a pretty suit. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was so much method to it.
I think there's so much pain these days when, you know, on top of losing a loved one, which is that you can't be around your family and your friends to grieve with others. You know, we found that, you know, every day people are losing people and are not able to, you know, say goodbye to them in person. If you sort of one step removed from that is how you celebrate a person. And can you imagine, Clark, if we were outside right now, what that would be like playing records to, you know, in tribute and celebration of Andre Harrell?
Honestly, I would try to imagine, but I don't know if there's a place that'll let a party go on for 20 days. If it was to celebrate Andre Harrell, it would be a nonstop 20-day party just because of the amount of happy that he exuded for 6 hours couldn't make it right. And you would need some place where you would be able to rotate people in and out. So it had to be a stadium. They'd have to know, okay, you get 4 hours and then you out of here because the line is going to be crazy.
It's not fair to compare the two. They're two different men. They've gone their own careers. Certainly they've worked together and they have history together. But is it fair to say that when you looked at Puff and the way that he wore his sunglasses or the way that he, you know, dressed up and had, you know, the jacket just fall just right, is it fair to say that without Andre Harrell, you don't get Sean Puffy Combs?
So you don't get Puff Daddy. You don't get a proper Jay-Z. You don't get a ton of us. You know what I'm saying? I'm from his class. You know what I'm saying? I was around when he was starting. So it's like I almost don't count. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was around when Russell Simmons was and all that. And I was in the game But I'm talking about the guys that got in the game after Andre. You wouldn't have seen him. You wouldn't have seen him. The game wouldn't have been wide open like that because he opened the doors for young Black America to look right in the music business. You know what I'm saying? So the record deals that would have got that got given away wouldn't have been the same. Those label situations, they wouldn't have been the same. If Andre Lorel doesn't crack that Al B. Shore, that Mary J. Blige, that Heavy D, that Father and Priest, and make you unafraid of hip hop. Mm. If he doesn't do that, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, Russ is doing what he's doing, but he's doing it the hardcore way. Andre's like, hold up, man. Do you know we like to get dressed up? Do you know we like to be fabulous? Do you remember the Cotton Club? Like, Andre's mind was like that. So, he made it so we could be fly and show everybody that we fly. And show everybody that we fly and we rap and make hard records and, like, yeah, be clear. We are fly. We really, really fly. That's Andre Harrell.
Well, thank God for Andre Harrell, and God bless the memory of Andre Harrell and the work of Andre Harrell. Before we let you go, Clark, there's a couple more things we want to talk about. Obviously, everyone has crowded around the television every Sunday night, obsessed with The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan documentary. Number one, have you been enjoying it? Number two, have you found out anything maybe you weren't aware of before or seen anything you weren't aware of before? And three, if you have any good Mike stories you want to share.
I guess the average answer for this is going to be what it is, you know, because there's a lot that you might speak to a lot of people who weren't actually paying good attention when Michael Jordan was happening. Like, I'm only a few years younger than Michael Jordan, so I was paying attention. when he came to the league, I was very wide awake going, oh, this shit is about to be crazy. Like, I watched Magic and Bird. I watched Isaiah Thomson. You know what I'm saying? I watched Bernard King. Mm-hmm. I'm a Knicks fan since the early 70s. I watched our championship from the 70s, the one from the 70s. Mm-hmm. I watched that. Mm-hmm. I know we won one in the 60s, but you know, I wasn't too much aware of that. But the one in the 70s, I was like 73. I saw it. I watched it. Mm. You know what I'm saying? I was cognizant of what was happening. So when new players came, I was paying attention. I loved sports since I was a little kid, and I was allowed to watch TV to watch what we had as New York sports. So I'm a Reggie Jackson fan. I'm a heavy Yankee fan, a heavy Knicks fan. You know what I'm saying? A heavy mm-hmm. Giants fan, mm-hmm. super heavy Giants. So when Michael Jordan comes, I'm like, oh shit, what is this? And you know, first when he first gets here, you're like, oh, this guy, he's going to be like Dr. J. And then it just becomes something else. He's like, oh, no, he's not like Dr. J. He's like Dr. J with a little bit of magic and a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of, wait a minute, he's even more than that. Mm. Because he just kept being crazier and crazier and crazier. And so when you hear him, and the people are talking about his attitude towards the way he approached the game, like, I don't have to hear that to know that that's what happened. I don't have to hear that. I don't have to hear that he beat up on his players or he was tough to his players on the team to know. I understand. There's nothing that you have to know. If you want to be a champion on that level and you're the leader of a team, you're going to be rough to your teammates, especially if they're not playing up to what you need them to play up to. Because as soon as they started playing up to what they need to, there's three championships in a row. As soon as he leaves, no championships. As soon as he comes back, three more. Like, it's him. He's that deal. There's never been a player that makes that serious of a difference when he goes and comes. If every time he went to the finals, he won. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to go visit the finals. I might lose this year. No, I get to the finals, I'm winning. And I'm not going seven games. I'm winning. We got to get up out of here. I got to go on vacation.
Yeah, I keep thinking about how different everything would be if Barkley had won against him. You know, if he only wins the two the first time around. Mm. You know, like, it because he was able to persevere and get that third one.
Yeah, because Magic and Larry didn't do three in a row.
And then he comes back, And he is just like, well, I can't just get one. Or I can get none. I have to get one. And if I get one, I have to get two. If I get two, I have to get three.
Yeah.
So like, well, it's a whole mentality that I just like do not have.
Well, he's special. The other part is I don't look at the what ifs. Because if that was the case, we'd have way too many conversations about what if this person did that or that person did this. Like, you go. We don't leave it right there. When he went to the finals, he was going to win. If he gets to the finals, he's going to win. And your mentality, knowing that he's coming to play you in the playoffs, is already like, he's probably going to win. Imagine that, walking into a situation going, he's probably going to win, but we still got to play.
Well, but Jay-Z has that sort of aura too, right? Where it's just like, oh, this guy is the best for a reason.
Well, Hov is the Jordan of the game.
Yeah.
So you should expect it. Hov looked at Rat like, yeah, I don't want to do that shit because I'm so far ahead of these dudes. I'd have to get in the game, slow down for them to get it, and then keep moving from the slowdown point. Like, he looked at rappers like, y'all want to be like me. Like, imagine that. Imagine being the guy who's looking at a rapper in an elevator going, this guy wants to be like me. This is hilarious.
Before we let you go, Clark, a couple weeks ago, there was this big uproar on Twitter, especially, where people were claiming that they first found out about Air Force Ones, or that Air Force Ones finally became cool when Nelly put out a song called Air Force Ones. Clark,
the floor is yours.
You want me to comment on that?
Clark, we love you. It's always a pleasure to talk.
Wait. Yeah. Was that a serious comment? Yeah. You know, like, before Nelly started to rap, Air Force Ones were cool. You dig what I'm saying? They were cool. They were already cool. Like, and let's be honest, they didn't wear cool Air Force Ones. They wore mid. Real Air Force One guys wore highs and lows. If you were making records, the records you were making records about mid. You didn't wear the right Air Force One, so you weren't that cool in the first place. You understand what I'm saying? So for me to hear that conversation, like, I why would I even pay attention? Like, even, like, I love Rocky. He that's my little man.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't let what he said affect me, so I don't know why Nelly let what he said affect him. Like, you come from after guys like us. You learned about Air Force Ones watching Mace and people like that. Like, and Mace learned that from being outside in Harlem when he was a little boy. You dig what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So, like, I can't look at the things that these dudes say and take offense to it. Like, we were rocking Air Force Ones before rap careers were jumping off.
And that is that on that.
So before you started to rap, Air Force Ones were already cool. Your father probably had Air Force Ones. Calm down.
Clark, you are the greatest. Thank you for everything. Stay safe. Take care of your family. Love to you and your family. We'll be checking
Thank
in, all right?
You guys, man. You're two of my favorites, man. Be good.
Jeff, let's now get on the phone with our friend, one of our former managers, and a cultural historian.
All the same person.
Archivist, biographer.
//.
Historian.
Yeah.
Naima Cochran.
Hello.
Naima!
What up?
Hi!
How are you?
It's my two favorite Upper West Side brothers.
Naima, first and foremost, how are you doing?
All things considered, I'm doing pretty well. I'm healthy. My friends and family are healthy. The biggest issue I probably have right now is that my sleeping schedule is thrown to hell, and if that's my biggest problem.
Naima, your sleep schedule has always been bad.
This is true. So imagine a person who already had issues with keeping any kind of routine at all whatsoever in the midst of a shutdown. It's pandemonium. in my house.
But shouldn't it be that, like, it's so off schedule that now it's on schedule?
In theory, except that it's off schedule in different ways all the time. So there was a week where I didn't go to bed every day until about 6 o'clock in the morning.
Sure.
And I got up at 11. And then it's, yeah, but for no reason. That's the thing. It's not like I was doing anything. I was playing Tekken. I was DJing. Like, it was whatever.
Playing
so
Tekken?
Right. So I got a PlayStation right before the shutdown because I was like, I need to have something.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, same. And like, we got an NES.
We have a Nintendo, yeah.
Right. So, like, for the first 3 weeks, it was basically like I was having camp in my house. So, I was learning how to DJ. I was learning Mortal Kombat, the latest Mortal Kombat, which is actually incredibly difficult, by the way. And then once people realized that we were going to be in this kind of indefinitely, work started picking back up. But yeah, for the first few weeks, it was a lot of cooking, eating, and just playing with stuff.
So, Naima, does this feel now that we're 2 months into it like it is the new normal?
Not yet. But it's moving closer towards that every day, especially in entertainment, as the streaming, as the live streaming entertainment is picking up, and brands and corporations are starting to figure out how to do it. And, you know, I knew we were in a state of normalcy once TV shows were embracing and adjusting to remote programming.
Saturday Night Live or
Parks and Rec.
Yeah, like, or, you know, yeah, like, not just the dailies, but the weekly shows. Mm-hmm. All Rise, the court drama that did their entire season finale remotely. The fact that reality shows are doing their reunion shows remotely.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is now becoming a thing, right? Production teams are adjusting. They're learning how to, you know, they're learning best practices. Brands are now trying to figure out how they're going to tap into the IG Live. So in the entertainment space, at least, there is a normalcy coming out of this, but there's still no real way to pivot from festival season and tour season in a real way.
Yeah.
So it remains to be seen what comes of that.
I saw something, and I don't put, you know, any sort of credence in this, but I did see that there's one artist who is, like, going to have his concert essentially at a drive-in, so people can sit in their cars to watch this person perform.
That doesn't seem fun.
Which sounds terrible.
Yeah.
It sounds terrible. I do see a lot more people talking about our drive-in options again. The problem with the drive-in situation is that there aren't a lot of drive-ins left in the country. That's
yeah.
A.
Yeah.
The ones that did exist have long since been torn down. B, you know, you would have to find, if you wanted to create new ones, you would have to find the real estate to allow for, like, a certain amount of cars. And, you know, the technology, I don't know how long that would take. Maybe it is the return of the drive-in. Who knows? But I still don't know if that works for a live experience, right? Like, even though we can get some of the same energy and sense of, you know, community as fans watching something on IG Live remotely in different ways, and we're learning that, it still isn't the same experience as being in a seat, being able to get up, having a crowd around you, you know, really hearing the sound wash over you, et cetera. Like, there's just really no way to duplicate that except that.
Yeah.
Well, that being said, people are going on Fortnite to watch Travis Scott. And apparently that's, like, wildly successful.
Or at least an image of Travis Scott.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's not actually Travis Scott. It's not even live. I don't understand anything.
Naima, this is a time now where I think a lot of people are trying to figure out their standing, whether it's with their company, whether it's with their career, whether it's just, like, how to move forward on a day-by-day basis. We're no strangers to pivoting. You're no stranger to pivoting. How do you feel now in this time of sort of unrest, as someone who has, you know, done a lot? At your core, you have skills, and those skills can translate to many different things, and you are not essentially, like, stuck in a corner.
Right. Well, I'll be honest. I knew early on, because most of the money that I earn comes in one way or another from things that require people being able to assemble, right? So I knew early on that my year financially was probably going to be a wash, and I just accepted that as what it is. And to you guys' point, my thought was like, okay, what skills do I pivot to? What is it going to look like? What do I need to adjust for to be ready for the rest of the year and possibly the first half of next year, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that meant leaning more on my writing, which I'm thankful to have as an outlet. And it's actually, ironically, provided a lot more opportunities for me to use my voice and for me to write for people. I've done a couple of guest lectures for classes. I've done more podcasts, appearances or features, guest spots, whatever you call it. But now I'm considering, do I, as my own Naima brand, which I'm sure you guys can relate to, as my own Naima brand, most of what I do usually is in support of other artists, talent, companies, et cetera. Do I want to move more to the forefront and create more of my own content?
Right.
Like, mm-hmm. do I want to move more to a video platform space? Do I want to hop on IG Live and do something? The only thing that's prevented me so far is just the amount of work that goes into it. Feels very daunting, right? Like, it seems very simple to outside viewers, but you guys know, like, you have to edit, mm-hmm. and you have to plan, and you have to, you know, do all these different things to get quality content out. So that's my thought, really, coming out of this is, okay, does this mean that I need to pivot more to stuff that's within my own control? Because, you know, basically the entire entertainment industry, gig industry, tour industry, live industry, all of this is, you know, hospitality industry, it's all in flux.
Yeah.
So it's kind of been like, okay, what's within my control that doesn't change regardless of the circumstances?
Absolutely.
And I think that's something we're all going to be trying to figure out for.
Well, and I think, you know, talking about your writing, you said the other night you were up at 3 a.m. So this all goes, you know, into everything we've spoken about already, which is you were up. You found out the news, obviously, about the passing of Andre Harrell. You mm-hmm. emailed Billboard and you said, I would like to be the one to really write the piece on this, to sort of look at the bigger perspective, not just the guy who gave Sean Puffy Combs a chance, right? I want to talk about legacy in terms of fashion, in terms of like being Black in America, in terms of the bigger picture. And I think that Jeff and I really, really appreciated that. I think that we've seen so many people across the timeline appreciate that. Can you just talk about what Ghetto Fabulous means to you? Can you talk about what Andre's and Uptown's music legacy is? And can you talk about what he has done for generation after generation in terms of being Black in America?
Sure. I got two calls about Andre shortly before Be Nice. I think Derek broke the news publicly when he announced it in his live. And I had already gotten a couple of calls, and I was waiting to find some confirmation on the timeline, but it was already maybe like 11:30 midnight. So as I was watching the news break and people react, I, like you guys said, I hit my editor at Billboard, like, I need to be the person to write this, because I knew that what many, I'm not going to say all, but what many mainstream outlets were going to report was about Andre founding Uptown, about Puffy, about Mary, about Jodeci. And Dre's legacy is way broader than that. And the first thing I should say is that I am indirectly a product of Dre because I started at Bad Boy.
Right.
And I started at Bad Boy when Dre was president at Bad Boy for a little while. And like half the executives at Bad Boy were former Uptown staff. Puffy's inner circle has always contained a lot of people who he started with at Uptown, which I don't think people really realize. So I saw firsthand, and I've seen over the years firsthand, like, how Dre interacts with not just artists, but with execs. Like you guys said, if you looked at the timeline from Friday night even to now, there were so many stories about how he was magnanimous with his wisdom, with his resources, how he saw people, how he took time, how he, you know, gave gems. You know, Andre had all kinds of quotes like, you know, whack, don't get whack juice on you, don't catch a brick. You know, he coined Ghetto Fabulous, which I'll get into in a second. and there were all kinds of Dre-isms, right? But also he was like all that preserve the sexy shit and everything that we all give Puff credit for, that started with Dre. That was Dre's thing. Dre was the lifestyle guy, and you know, and he was in this game from the very beginning, started at Rush, was best friends with Russell, was one of the first, you know, was an early rap, part of an early rap act in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And in a day when people were wearing, you know, either Houdini, which was doing all kinds of leather and, you know, some rat, you know, some raccoon tails and some other miscellaneous
wide brim hats,
whatever.
yeah,
wide brim hats, or your Run DMC with, you know, Kangols and Adidas and gold rope chains. Andre and his partner Alonzo were in Italian silk suits, you know, and they were rapping about watches and girls and money and champagne in 1981, right? When, like, 20 years before the bling era. But it was party rap. Like, they actually had a song called Champagne Rap. It was party rap, and party rap wasn't really a thing yet. And it was aspirational, which I think, you know, was a hint of what he was going to do with Uptown. And one thing he always, in terms of the ghetto fabulousness, one distinction Andre always made between, like, the reason he left Rush and left Def Jam, and the distinction he always made between him and Russell was that Russell was a kid from the suburbs who was enamored with street stuff, right? Like, he loved that really hard, gritty street shit because it was a novelty to him. And Andre's thing was, I'm from the project. Andre's from Bronxville Project. He's like, I'm from the project. None of that is sexy. Like, people where I come from want, like, glamour and luxury, and they want aspirational things, but also people from the project, and this is where Dale Fabulousness comes in, you may only be able to afford one fly bag or one designer pair of jeans or one really fly pair of kicks, but you're going to rotate those couple of high-end pieces that you're able to get and mix high-low. Like, people from the ghetto were doing high-low before high-low was, like, a thing that blogs were covering and everything. So you're going to mix that, you know, build outfits around that and change up the ways in which you can wear that, that still looks fly and still looks stylish. And that was what ghetto fabulousness was. Even though Andre patterned, in a large part, his own career in Uptown after Motown, what Motown did was take blackness and polish up the shiniest parts of it, right? Make it very clean and neat. Everybody stand up straight, everybody articulate, you know, all of that, and make it very palatable for a white audience. Berry Gordy very much wanted white listeners because that's how you got pop hits. Yes, it was a black label, but it was a blackness that was packaged for mainstream consumption. Andre was like, I'm not going to just give you full street that you are going to find novelty in, nor am I going to take the street all the way out so that it feels more accessible for you. I'm going to show you high Negro style, ghetto glamour, you know, black flyness that has the edge and has the cool, and I'm going to show you how these two things can go together. And that was something that no other music company or entertainment company was doing at that point. So he started that movement of, you know, being from the street but still fly, being able, not having to assimilate in order to be considered like upper echelon, you know. And he did it right at a moment when the black upper middle class was growing, right at a moment when hip-hop was starting to make more money and become a larger business. So as young black people were getting money, it's like Uptown was really like the label of young black wealth.
You know, to do that is one thing. To do that in the face of, I'm sure, a lot of white executives who did not understand what was going on and did not want to give him the leverage to do what he wanted. And I think you would see that later in his career, too. But let's talk about like Uptown. To do that and succeed on such a level, I think, is just the biggest compliment to him, and the way that he can remain himself and build other people up.
Yeah, indeed. And actually, as he was leaving Uptown to move into Motown and actually take, you know, Barry's former slot as chairman of Motown, he did, he was remorseful a little bit that he didn't have a better situation. So, for example, he started Uptown, I want to say maybe right before LaFace was formed, and obviously way before, you know, Bad Boy was formed. But there was some speculation, like, had he gone to Clive, mm-hmm. right? Clive was letting these giving these labels a lot more latitude to do what they do because Clive had a better understanding, possibly, of black music, or at least knew enough to know he needed to turn the black music over to the people who knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Whereas Andre felt hamstrings. You know, he actually said, he was like, I would have loved to get Mary. You know, I sold 3 million with Jodeci, I sold X million with Mary. I would have loved to get them to a 6 million point like Toni Braxton. Mm. You know, I would have loved, like, Mary and Jodeci were stars by their sophomore album, but neither of them became full-blown, like, really big stars until they moved to MCA proper. So, and that was one of the things that really bothered him, was black executives were good to spot the talent and grow the talent, but once the talent really popped, the white executives took it over.
Right.
And the black executives were basically put back out in the field to find some more talent and repeat the process all over again. So he did feel that MCA never really got what he was trying to do, even though they claimed to, and that they never really gave him the, whether it be funding or latitude or autonomy or control that he really needed to build the label up, to build his artists up as big as he thought they could be. It was wonderful that he had all these platinum selling acts across the label, but he always felt that they could have been even bigger. Like, you know, he would have loved to have created a TLC, a Toni Braxton, etc., the way that LA and FaZe were able to.
Do you think that Heavy D was maybe his most underrated success when you think back about his whole career?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Heavy D is the most underrated everything in hip-hop at all times. In hip-hop, in music, anything. If the question is Heavy D, yes, he's the most underrated, whatever. Because, for a couple of reasons. The first reason being that Andre built Uptown around Heavy. Dre wanted to sign Heavy. Russell was like, he's fat, nobody's gonna get it. Dre was like, nah, the girls are gonna dig him, he's charismatic. He's lovable. He's got style. He's got flair.
He can move.
You know, he can move. He's like on his feet. And that was like the catalyst for him to form his own thing, because he saw what Heavy could be. And not only did he build the label around Hev, but Hev was a consistent platinum artist for a large amount of his career. B is credited as one of the first hip-hop artist, because it was friendly party rap, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Accessible, danceable, fun rap. He was one of the first artists to kind of really break all the way into the mainstream. Even though he never had a pop hit, white people knew who Heavy D was. Like, he was pop,
yeah,
was friendly.
Wait, but so, isn't that automatically
Michael Jackson?
That makes him a pop.
Well, yeah, I mean, with the collaboration with Michael Jackson, right? So he was tapped. Like, Heavy did collaborations with Janet and Michael. He was on All Right, and he was on
mm-hmm,
Damn.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the first, Heavy D and the Boys were one of the first acts to be in Sprite's Obey Your Thirst campaign.
Yep.
I think he might have been the first. It was either him or Kid and Play first, but they were both the first. And you know, he's the voice behind the In Living Color theme song. Like, Hev was...
And he went to Hollywood.
And he went to Hollywood. Like, Hev... I think that Hev still had a much bigger acting career ahead of him, had he not passed so that suddenly and untimely. But yeah, and he was actually a good actor, right? And when Dre created Uptown Entertainment, the TV and film vehicle, he actually did have a sitcom in development with Hev as the centerpiece that never made it all the way to screen. So I think he had intentions on doing more for Hev and putting Hev in the center more. The other thing about Heavy, though, is that Heavy was immensely talented in a way I don't think people know. So Andre didn't discover Puff. Hev brought Puff
mm-hmm,
to Uptown.
Mm-hmm.
Hev brought Al B. Sure to Uptown.
Mm-hmm.
Hev brought Pete Rock was Heavy's cousin. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
Heavy brought Eddie up to Uptown. Heavy was the one who, along with another, like Heavy heard Jodeci sing with another executive. That one executive was about to tell them no. Heavy took them into Andre, like, you need to listen to them. By the time Andre left, Hev was EVP of the company. Heavy took the helm.
Yeah.
You know? And Soul For Real was his act, and Soul For Real was the first Motown pop number one. Hev was incredibly talented, incredibly, like, versatile, just really smart. And so he was such an essential, he was such a more essential figure to Uptown's legacy and to hip-hop origins, period, and hip-hop soul's origins, period, than I think people really gave him credit for ever. And so, yeah, I do think that people underestimate how important Heavy is to Andre's story and to Uptown's story. People always make it about Puff and Jodeci and Mary, and there's so many other figures in this cast.
You know, I Naima, I just want to say that your music sermons on Twitter and on Vibe and everywhere that you've put them are so good, and you have to put them like in a book or something. Like, something has to come from this. Like, your depth of knowledge on music history.
Yeah, I think you see a lot. People like to say we're losing our recipes, you know, more and more.
Yeah.
And I think that with people like you to catalog them, to archive them, to look after them has been especially important as more and more people do pass on.
Yeah, thank you guys for that. First of all, I will say that since we've been in shutdown, I finally have decided, you know, what my first book is going to be. People have been pushing me to do one for a minute, and I couldn't figure out what to focus on to start, and I finally have. So I'm working on a proposal now. But I'm going to take it back to Combat Jack, who was my first boss in the industry, Reggie Osei. Music Sermon was already well underway, and you guys, I think, both know this. Like, it started completely by accident. You guys actually knew me at the time that I started it. It really came out of a place of me not of the business not being fun for me anymore,
mm-hmm.
and wanting to. It started from a place of nostalgia, just wanting to remember things that were more celebratory, things that were more uplifting, just a happier times that music recalled for me, whether it was the music I grew up with or it was music that I worked on or that I was around for early in the game. There's different eras of the business. And then I realized that there was also room for education, because there were so many figures that were undersung, if not unsung altogether, or where over time their depth and breadth of contribution had kind of been forgotten, like an Andre, or even like a Babyface. Face was, I think, the third music sermon I ever did once it became a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was so happy to see, like, the Teddy and Babyface battle, like the number of people that wanted to watch them and bear witness to that. That made me really happy. But when Reg died, right before he died, he hit me, and he told me that he was really proud of what I was doing, which meant everything coming Man. From him, because he had done basically my goal is to do with R&B and certain aspects of hip hop, what Reg was doing for rap and hip hop with the Combat Jack Show,
mm-hmm.
which was a level of storytelling and archival and also allowing the people that were there to come in and tell stories that other people maybe hadn't heard before, or just to remind people of things that they had possibly forgotten. Because the great and terrible thing about the digital age is that there's so much information for you to find, but also everything is so immediate. Like, our attention spans are so short that you can really already forget about how massive something that happened in 1999 was.
Yeah.
You know? So I felt like I owed it to him, in a sense, to his legacy, you know, as I was seeing people talk about what he meant to them and what his platform and his work meant to them, and thinking for myself about, like, what do I want my work to be for, right? Like, the thing about being in the entertainment industry that's tricky is that very few people actually retire from this shit. Like, either you get fired or unfortunately, you know, you die early because you worked yourself to death, or you know, something else happens, or you're just not hot anymore. And it's not a long game for a lot of people, and you have to have an exit plan. And that was kind of my thing, was like, what is my end game in working in music and entertainment? What is my end game as a creative? What impact do I want to have when all is said and done? So even though this started as something to feed my own soul, when I realized that there was more here that I could give to other people, and that it was actually creating a community of people on Twitter that had like interests and like memories that they could share with each other and talk about, I realized that I wanted to pour more into that. So I never intended for it to lead to me becoming, you know, an actual music journalist, culture critic, all of those things, but it's definitely something that's always been in my spirit. And it just does make me really happy to keep voices, names and voices and stories lifted that otherwise might not be.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Naima, before you get out of here, or before we let you go, rather, I wanted to ask you, John Legend is rumored to be the next Versus against Alicia Keys.
Yes.
And I wanted to know what you think the outcome will be, as someone who
completely unbiased.
No, yeah. I saw that. I actually need to text Jay about that, because I saw that and I was like, I mean, it makes sense. The Battle of the Dueling Pianists, right?
Right.
Jay is not, if John sticks to his early album, the Get Lifted era,
mm-hmm.
he can knock this out the park.
Yeah.
easy. But that would be my strategy. So Jay, even if John's not listening, I'm actually gonna text him and tell him this. So if he sticks to the Get Lifted and the Once Again era, and then touches on the hits later, the Green Light,
mm-hmm.
you know, All of Me.
Mm.
See, but he could also bring out like the Rick Ross features. Like he could do like,
yeah, that's the other thing. Yeah, he has deep, like John has deep features. Crazy deep features. And if he really wanted to, it might almost be cheating, but if he really wants to fuck people up, he could hit Alicia with her own song, because John is singing the ooh-oohs on You Don't Know My Name.
Wow. So
here we go.
it could be like a Jill Erica moment where Erica's like, I'm gonna play this song, and then Jill's like, well,
I'll play it too.
So they could do that. John is playing keys on Everything Is Everything. John's on, you know, Celebration by Kanye.
Oh yeah.
John's on a couple of joints from Kingdom Come for Jay. So like, if he really wanted to fuck people up, he could do that. If he wants to go
the other thing is that, like, I also worry that it's going to be like the softest gloved like battle, like even outside of like, you know, Erica and Jill, like it's just like they, like it's going to be a compliment off. Like John is so nice, Alicia is so nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, they gotta bring a little bit of fun and snark, and John can get snarky when he wants to. He can definitely do it. Chrissy helped sharpen those skills in him.
Yeah.
He can get snarky when he wants to. Alicia has to be game for it. I don't know if Alicia is ever comfortable moving out of the Love and Light space.
Right,
but
right.
Also, Alicia will have Swiss helping coach, right?
Who is the best? Yeah.
So I do think actually that John and Alicia could be a good thing, because one of the comments I saw after Jill and Erica was like, it's great that we have the women now, but why do we have to segment it?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think that it would be dope to have two peers and very similar types of artists go head to head, who like that's a man and a woman, instead of it being the men against the men and the women against the women. But yes, my recommend, I think it could be interesting and fun if each of them stick with their jam.
All right.
And their early work, because that's really the trick to this Versus thing. Like, there's hits and then there's hits. People don't necessarily want your chart hits. We want the jam. We want the stuff that makes us move and that really resonates.
Wait, you weren't there for Lil Jon turned down for what?
Yo, if I could tell you, if y'all knew how mad I was John, when John Clay fucking turned down. Listen, because everybody was waiting for Bia Bia. Everybody. Like, one of my friends on Twitter was like, when he plays Bia Bia, I'm calling one of these kids downstairs to catch an elbow.
That's right, that's right.
I was like ready to stand on my couch. I was trying to figure out what was safe to throw.
Naima was going to stay up all night, not because she was waiting for this, but because she just doesn't sleep anymore. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I was like, I was ready to run around the living room, do something, and he played Turn Down for What?
Yo, I went crazy. I was like, yo, this is my jam. This is the song I've been waiting for.
Naima,
talk about not reading the room.
Naima, your voice has always been important. It's never been more important than it is now. We look forward to everything that comes out of this, especially your book proposal and hopefully the book down the line. We love you. Take care of yourself. Stay safe, and we'll be checking in. All right.
Thank you, guys. I love you too,
Jeff. Now let's get on the phone with our friend and Atlantic Records Vice President of A&R, Jeff Sledge,
legend.
Jeff!
What up?
What's happening?
Yeah!
Jeff, good to hear your voice in these crazy times.
Social distancing streets.
Yo, listen, it has been, it's 2 months, maybe more than 2 months. It's wild that we've gotten to this place. How are you doing, first and foremost?
I'm doing all right, man. You know, I'm doing all right under the circumstances. Obviously, like, definitely, you know, a little stir crazy, definitely a little cabin fever, even though I do get out,
yeah,
you know, when I can. Like, you know, I'm not crazy. I'm always, you know, wearing a mask and gloves and everything, but I ride my bike when I can to get some air. But it's wild because even with that, I don't enjoy riding my bike like I used to because I'm so anxious when I'm outside. Like, you know, like, am I breathing it in? Am I too close to somebody?
Yeah.
Am I, you know, getting too far away from the crib? All of that stuff. Definitely the kind of anxiety of being outside, it gets to me, you know?
Yeah, Jeff, I saw, maybe like a month ago or so, and people were like, obviously social distancing, obviously watching the news, understanding, you think, what's going on. And then I saw you would post that people still uptown would be outside like it was a regular Saturday or Sunday.
Yeah, last weekend, not this Mother's Day weekend, this past, but last weekend, the weather in New York was really nice. You know, you guys remember,
yeah.
Saturday, Sunday were pretty warm and, you know, clear skies. And, yeah, man, like, I'm riding through Harlem, and it's like I'm just seeing a lot of people. It's weird, because people have a mask. They'll actually have a mask on, but they'll have it tucked under their chin.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So it's like, you got it on, but your face is while it's on your body, but it's not
doing anything.
Your chin is good, but your face is wide open. So, like, what's the point? It's almost like a fashion statement to, like, wear a mask but not have it on your face. It's weird, man.
Just does not do anything.
Jeff, you're scary.
Obviously, we lost a legend with Andre Harrell. I saw the post that you put up. I want to ask you what your thoughts are on the man and the body of work and the legend.
Yeah, well, I respected Andre long before I met him, you know, just being a kid trying to figure out how to even do music. I had no idea, but, you know, the Uptown Records, Uptown and Def Jam are kind of like the two of the first labels that kind of, you know, captured the New York black energy. And just, you know, Andre was just, you know, just legendary dude to me. So when I got into the music biz, you know, I met him a few times over the years, and then what happened is O'Neal McKnight, mm-hmm. was his cousin, and I became really, really close. We're still, you know, really good friends to this day. And then that kind of gave me, you know, a chance to get to know Andre much better via O'Neal, because O'Neal lived with him, so I'd, you know, be at the house and stuff,
yeah, yeah,
and hanging out and stuff. So then I got to know Andre better. And you know, the dude, you know, what's interesting about Andre is that he was. And I don't mean, like, I have to kind of preface this by saying this. I don't mean this in any type of negative way, but, like, one of his geniuses was, like, everything he did or, like, looked at or thought about was through that lens of, you know, ghetto fabulous, mm-hmm. uptown and flyness. Like, there was everything was that. You had like Andre was the dude that would absolutely look you up and down. You know what I'm saying? What are you wearing? Oh, your man got on the okay. And if you got a compliment from Dre, for me it like lifted my whole day because it was like, okay, what I put on, I did it right.
Yeah.
You know, everything, even you know, from obviously he was super successful in music, and then he went into movies, and he went into, you know, New York Undercover with television. Mm-hmm. Then he did Revolt with Public. But everything was through that lens, and it was a lesson that I learned from him to kind of almost like be myopic in a way. Like, it's like, if this is what you're going to do, then this is what you're going to do. And not to, you know, say that, you know, he, you know, obviously he loved his family, he loved his son, like all that. Like, it's not about him being like an asshole to people, because he actually was a beautiful person to people. But he was just so like locked into like this kind of thing, mm. and making everything around him be, whether figuring out whether whatever around him fit into that thing or not.
Can you talk about the difference between you know, style before Andre and style afterwards? Because he did bring in that champagne rap, that sort of like that difference where it wasn't necessarily like what Russell was bringing into the game. This was something new.
Yeah. See, you kind of nailed it. The big difference was, and I don't want to just kind of attribute to Russell. I just mean in general, like people in that era, it was, you know, hip hop was still pretty new, and everything was kind of seen through the lens of hip hop. Like, you know, wearing Adidas or wearing, you know, like leather outfits and, you know, name belts and name chains and, you know, dookie ropes and all that stuff. Everything was seen through that lens. And Andre, from the beginning, always, maybe even from when he was rapping as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, he wore a suit and a tie, you know what I'm saying, and those kind of glasses that stockbrokers would wear. Like he didn't have a Caesar, he had like a little fro. Like he always had a different thing. Like he was hip hop for sure, like he was hip hop to his core, but he also had like a aspirational, that's what he was. He was way more aspirational than anybody was in that era. In other words, he was like, I want to go. He would rap about it, like, I'm, you know, going to Paris, I'm going to Saint-Tropez, I'm going to, you know, like, that was his thing, like, kind of like, take this hip-hop and this kind of uptown energy, but we're going to take this and go to the Hamptons, and we're going to go to, you know, Turks and Caicos. And so he opened up a world to kids who didn't even know that world existed.
Like Sean Puffy Combs.
He didn't even know these worlds existed. Like, wow, like people have houses in the Hamptons, and like you go out there in the summer and you lay on your, you know, by your deck by the pool or go on the beach, and you can actually still work, but it's like so fly, and there's models and there's champagnes flowing, and you know, we kind of kicking it, and there's a whole kind of different, again, lifestyle that just we didn't even know existed back then that Andre had figured out and made it his life's mission to take us to those places.
Yeah, I think today we can all look back and you sort of take it for granted that it's always been here. You know, people like to dress up like it was 20 years ago, but that 20 years ago didn't exist, you know, before Andre, before Uptown, before Puff, before, you know, Heavy D and everyone who was over there. So what does Uptown Records, when you look back at it, mean from the aspect of this is a black entrepreneur who was like 26 when he founded it, to the you know, the credit that MCA and PolyGram and everyone who would like invest in him and Motown give him a chance. Like, what do you think as a music man of Andre Harrell, the music man?
I was like I said it on my post, like I genuinely looked up to him and was in awe of him, like at all times, even when we would, you know, kind of be in a casual setting and hanging out. In my mind, I'm like, yo, I'm fucking hanging out with Andre Harrell. I just admired him so much. I mean, he was a genius. Like he was like I you know, when I have these conversations, I'm like look at that roster. Like, look at the roster this guy had. This guy had Guy, he had Mary, he had Heavy, he had Jodeci, like on the same roster at the same time. For him to take these artists who obviously were all amazing artists, but he really like developed them. Like, you know, Heavy D was just like, you know, Heavy Sit Cat from Mount Vernon. He was just trying to rap a little bit. Mary was, you know, this hood girl, no disrespect, from Yonkers, from the projects, and, you know, sung a little bit and messed around. Like, and he really cultivated them into like international stars, international superstars. he was a genius. I mean, you know, like he could just look at something, you know, even later on, like, you know, I'm gonna do a TV show about some cops. It's gonna be a black dude, it's gonna be a Puerto Rican dude, but they detectives, but they still fly. You are looking at Halle Berry and being like, I'm gonna put this girl in her first movie, Strictly Business.
Yeah,
like he just had a vision. He just had an innate, obviously an innate, you know, feeling about things, but he had a vision that, you know, I think a lot of people didn't even really understand at first, but he knew what he was doing, and to get a blessing from Dre was a big thing. And you see, like, the stars that he, you know, pushed out into the world. The guy was a genius, man. Straight up, he's a genius.
Well, I mean, like, talk about how just the absence of, like, a black owned company, like, what the game is missing in 2020.
Yes. Well, I got a lot of thoughts about this. I mean, I think that a lot of this stuff, the lack of black-owned companies was, you know, I hate to be like conspiracy sledge, but I think a lot of it was by design. I it happened with Andre, it happened with L.A. Reid, it happened with Russell, where these guys, you know, all three of them, you know, icons, and built these, you know, companies from zero. And, you know, mined and found and nurtured black talent on both sides now. I don't want to forget that, too. Not just the artists, on the executive side, too.
Mm-hmm.
Both, all these people, nurtured executives that have gone on to do things as well. And I feel like once these black companies get to a certain level where they're generating a certain amount of bread, what happens is, you know, the big corporation comes down with a massive check, and it's kind of hard for somebody to turn down the type of money that, you know, Andre, you know, L.A. Reid and Russell got for their companies, and then kind of takes the talent and, you know, kind of absorbs it, and then, you know, things get a little weird. I hate that. You know, again, Dre got a chance to run Motown Records, which is when he left, you know, Uptown, and Motown obviously is a huge legacy company. Mm-hmm. And you know, they paid him a ton of money and gave him all type of autonomy and allowed him to hire people. So, like, again, I'm not dogging Dre for doing it, but I hate that constantly happens, because, you know, if he would have kept Motown, like, what would it be today? You know, if L.A. Reid would have kept LaFace, like, all the artists in Atlanta probably would have been assigned to him.
Yeah.
They all would have been the Future. All these guys would have been, they would have been assigned to L.A. So I hate that that happens. And I hate that there's not, you know, many black companies that are still kind of doing what Andre and Russell and L.A. and Jermaine,
yep,
you know, what they did. They're so important to the culture. And it's the same kind of play over and over again. I hate it.
Yeah. One black-owned company that I think we all love and respect is Rockefeller Records. But before there was Rockefeller Records, another post that you made on Instagram recently was your sort of... you said that it was meant to be that Rockefeller Records would happen, but DJ Clark Kent did bring Dame,
yes,
and Jay-Z to you, and
he did.
And there was a thought that maybe you guys would do something with Rockefeller and Jive together that wasn't meant to be.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I told the story on Instagram. I've been doing these A&R stories,
which are great, by the way. They're so great.
Thank you. And it just kind of just popped in my head to do it. It's totally organic. It's no kind of, people keep asking me, like, what are you gonna do? And I'm like, I don't know, bro. I'm just kind of doing it. It's just flowing out of me, and let's see where it goes. But yeah, that particular story was, Clark, you know, who I've known since I started in the music business, you know, told me that he had his boy from Brooklyn, Jay-Z, who's the best rapper in the world, and I need to meet him. And we did this meeting. And again, like I said in the story, Jay rhymed differently then, but back then he was still rhyming very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
In a kind of quick style. He hadn't, you know, molded his style into what it's obviously become now. And, you know, I told him that he kind of reminded me of Tretch, because Tretch, you know, rap like that. And that definitely was like, you know, well, this meeting's about over. And face was kind of like, this motherfucker here. And obviously, you know, shit, I didn't stop there, Flo. They went on to do great things. And like I said, and the thing, what I learned from that meeting, and I've never done that ever since, is like, I didn't really ask them what their plan was. I just listened to the music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if I'd have talk to Jay and Dame and, you know, and Clark about, because Biggs wasn't in the meeting. I don't know if he was involved with them yet.
But he wouldn't have talked anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Biggs would have just been in the corner anyway. But if I would have talked to them about what the plan was, like how they were going to kind of do this street movement and, you know, make Rockefeller this thing and, you know, kill the clubs and, you know, they had like a old Benz and they had wrapped it with Rockefeller logo and mm-hmm. they would park in front of the club and play their Jay's music. Like, if I'd have heard all that stuff, I think I would have looked at it differently. And then, like I said in the story, you know, then over the years I would see them all the time. I mean, the music business was based in New York, so I'd run into them, and then, you know, would always be love. Like, yeah. Me and Jay would talk on the phone. We're not like friends, nothing like that, but like, you know, from time to time, you know, we'd cross paths, and then obviously then when he did Big Pimpin' with UGK, like, yep. We had a lot of interaction there, and then he did Best of Both Worlds with R. Kelly, and mm-hmm. we had, you know, a lot of interaction during that period, and I remember, like, Jay came to the studio to meet R. Kelly for the first time. Rob was recording in New York, and Rob had this beat that he played Jay that he wanted to rap on, when Jay rap on, and nothing ever came of that. But I remember Dame was trying to buy that beat, and he would call me all the time, and, yo, we want to buy the beat. That beat was hard. And I was talking to, you know, R. Kelly's manager, Barry Hankerson, and he's like, I don't know nothing about selling beats. I don't know how you sell a beat. I don't know if I'm fucking selling no beat. You know, but my point was, it was always like crossing paths with those guys over the years and having conversations, and, you know, it's all love. But yeah, you know, I guess it just wasn't meant to be.
Where were you when the R. Kelly Jay-Z tour went up in smoke?
I was there. I was at the show. Great seats too. Like, oh my! Like, probably like 15 or something, like dead center, Madison Square Garden. So I was right there, like when it all happened, and just, yeah, like, you know, it was interesting because Jay, you know, I think Rob, I don't know if Rob thought it out properly. In other words, Rob is coming out, and, you know, Rob, they're both massive artists at the time.
Big
and
headliners, coming, yeah.
You're big headliners, massive headliners, and then Rob had come out on Fade to Black and all that. So like, they had, you know, they had done stuff before, but Rob is coming out, and he's doing like his records, which are, you tend to be kind of slow. Mm-hmm. You know, Body's Calling, you know, Bump and Grind, and
yeah,
stuff like that, and you know, the crowd is into it. But then when Jay comes out, and he's doing, like, you know, I don't know, PSA wasn't at that time, but whatever the big kind of records were at that time, you know, Give It to Me and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, the crowd is obviously going crazy, and then Rob comes out, and then the crowd sits down. And then Jay comes out, and the crowd goes up, and then Rob comes out, and the crowd sits down. So Rob, I believe, also felt like Rob, especially it being in New York, in Jay's hometown, Rob was very frustrated because he couldn't get the crowd going the way he wanted. Meanwhile, like, when Hov comes out, it's like, you know, nuclear explosion every time it's stage. Yeah, and then Rob comes out, and just, you know, the stage lights are still dark, and he's like, I ain't doing this no more. Somebody's out here flashing the gun at me, and it ain't like that. And it just turns into that, and everybody's literally like, is this part of the show? Like, nobody could believe it. They're like, wait, this must be part of the show. This is going to be crazy. And then, you know, like 10, 15 minutes, it's like 10 minutes or so, like, there's nobody on stage.
Man.
And then all of a sudden, I remember then the crowd starts going, Hova, Hova, Hova. And that gets louder and louder, and they're yelling for Jay to come out.
Man.
And Jay comes out, and he says some slick shit, as he always does, about Rob not wanting to do the show. And then he literally starts pulling people out the crowd and out of backstage. And then he's like, yo, if you got to see it, it's actually, next time you guys talk to Lenny S, you should ask, because Lenny S was actually like taking people's CDs and putting them in to play on the Madison Square Garden stage so they could perform.
What? Jesus.
Yeah. People like, yo, give me your stage, or your DAT tape, or your show tape, or whatever. And Lenny would, like, load it up, and then they would come out, and they would do two or three songs. T.I. came out.
Yep.
Usher came out. Yeah. Lenny was the guy, like, doing it.
That's so good.
It's insane. It was an insane night, bro. It was an insane night.
Jeff, it's sort of impossible to predict, you know, all the trends moving forward, but hey, that's the business that you're in, right? So I figured that we would ask you this. We talked to a friend recently. She's a fashion editor, and she was telling us that when this is all said and done, maybe it's 6 months from now, maybe it's a year from now, maybe it's 2 years from now, people who have been dressing up in basically sweatsuits or, you know, just very relaxed.
Yeah, real cozy wear.
Clothing, yeah.
Yeah.
They're going to come out of here. They're going to be, like, dressed up in suits. It's going to be more flashy, more back to that early 90s thing. So is there any possibility that we're going to get four on the floor, more up-tempo dance music at the end of all this?
Yes. I think that that happens in throughout history. That has happened after, you know, way back after, like, you know, World War II, like, rock and roll was invented. You know what I'm saying? And it was obviously, that was a very, like, energetic music.
Rest in peace, Little Richard, by the way.
Yeah, it, totally rest in peace to the architect, Little Richard. And then in the 70s, when, you know, it was like the gas prices were through the roof, and, you know, it was, I guess it was a recession at that point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was just dark, and people were coming home from Vietnam, and, you know, drug issues, a lot of shit. We got disco, mm-hmm. and, like, a lot of funk music. So the music does tend to, the pendulum does tend to swing up when the country comes out of a dark period. So I do think we're going to get more up-tempo, dancey, you know, fun music. And you're seeing it now even, like, with the TikToks that are happening. You know, God
which
bless
are all fun, every single one.
That's my point. Which are all fun. You know, you had the you know, the Ty Dolla $ign Wiz record.
Yep.
I have, you know, me and Missy have we did the cool off challenge.
Yep.
You know, everything is up tempo and fun, and it's people participating in it together, like with families and stuff. You know, people are their friends, and people are kind of communing over this dance, fun, up tempo music. And I do think that we're gonna that feeling and that energy is going to keep going once the you know, whatever the other side of this looks like. I don't know what it's going to look like, but yeah, I do think dark music is going to kind of take a back seat.
Well, I mean, like, how does that inform what acts you're looking at moving forward? Or does it? I mean, like, is that just sort of like a mood that will come and go, and the acts can do what fits the mood? But, like, are you, when you search for music right now, like, what are you looking for?
I haven't really changed what I'm looking for, because I've always kind of looked for things that are, you know, unique and different, and have an element of fun, or I don't know if humor is the right term, but I guess a little lightness underneath to them, you know, even if they're, you know,
hot styles maybe.
Yeah, hot styles, stanky legs.
Yeah.
But that hasn't really changed. I think what's gonna happen, which is a good thing, is again, because of all the TikTok stuff and everybody being, and the kids on TikTok are just, the creativity is stunning. Actually, it's literally stunning to me sometimes when I see some of the things that they do. I think that this is allowing them obviously a bigger platform, because people are paying more attention to that, and that bigger platform is going to give them more confidence to not be, to feel like they have to fit in.
Yeah, Jeff, one last thing before we
out.
One last thing before we let you go, which is, yep. Man, could you imagine if we were all outside right now celebrating Andre and that whole catalog?
My God. I just talked to a buddy of mine about that recently, because it's sad, obviously, that he can't get a proper homecoming, mm-hmm. homegoing, rather, because of, you know, rules and stuff. And it's, to me, sad that we can't go to, you know, a party or a brunch or a cookout or whatever, and play, like, you know, the Uptown catalog, and be amongst, you know, each other and dancing and having a good time to, you know, Guy or Heavy D or Mary or whoever. Yeah, it is. I mean, I think we'll still get to do it, but yeah, I mean, and that's something and Dre would have just loved that.
Yeah, well,
everybody partying to his music would have been like the best shit ever for him.
Absolutely. Well, Jeff, while we're here, we'd like to celebrate everyone. We salute you. We thank you. We love you, Jeff. Take care of yourself up there, and we'll be talking soon, all right?
Love you guys, too. 914.
There we go! Shout out to Jeff Sledge, shout out to Naima Cochran, and shout out to the one and only DJ Clark Kent. Jeff, are we back tomorrow?
We are back every day forever.
As always, guys, now for real, for real.
Sure.
We'll see you guys tomorrow!